I mentioned yesterday our online service where we have 1,200 films available. Just a quick recapture of how we clear the rights with that. We did it on a title-by-title basis with every individual rights holder. And in the end, we didn't have to pay one single euro to put the films online, and it's all for free. The only condition for some of the titles were that for 50 of them, the rights holder demanded it to be geo-blocked, so it's only available from Sweden, but for all the other films are available from anywhere in the world for free. What I will be talking about now is another digitization project, more on the high end. Just a bit of background. Lobbying takes time, as you all know. I just want to mention in this context a seminar we held in Stockholm in April 2013, where we had members from the European Commission and the president of the ACE present and invited key players from the industry, from media, and from the political side to listen to why it is important to receive additional funding for digitization, or rather, what would be the consequences if we don't. And as you can see, 6 months later, we were told that we would get an additional funding of 40 million Swedish crowns, approximately a little bit more than 4 million euros, for which we are expected to digitize 500 films in 5 years. We decided to use the money by doing the digitization in-house for two reasons. First of all, for curatorial reasons. Instead of going to commercial providers to have the work done, we thought digitization of analog collections should be done in an environment where there is analog know-how. But also for financial reasons, it turned out to be much cheaper than to go to commercial providers. We used the 40 million crowns by acquiring equipment. What we didn't acquire yet is our own scanner. However, we use a scanner that is owned by a commercial post-production house, which don't use it all the time, so we have a license agreement with them. We can use it, and it's our staff who goes to them and do the scanning of our films. And then we hired staff, 9 new people. Here you can see what they are working with, but these 9 new people, 2 of them are only working on the analog side of it. It's important to remember that it's a lot of analog work involved in a mass digitization project. So, how many films do we have in the collection to choose the 500 films from? This is the figures for the Swedish films we have in our collection. We have a large number of international films, of course, but these films are not subject for this digitization project. Unless there are co-productions, Swedish-Danish co-productions, Swedish-Norwegian co-productions, then we check with the corresponding archive in the other countries, are you planning to do something with this film? If they are, we don't. If they don't, we will do it. And of course, in our collection of our international films, there are some unique holdings that we know we are the only ones holding that film. These films will eventually also be subject for digitization in our collection. So 500 films out of 8,500 films. Is it a selection, or as we maybe utopians still like to think of it, just making an order of priority? Because if we do 100 films a year, which 500 films in 5 years implies, and if you recalculate the duration of the short films into feature films, it would take us 40 years to digitize our entire collection of Swedish films. Maybe we can do it, maybe we can't do it. It also depends on whether we get additional funding after 2018, of course. So what kind of selection criteria do we have? As I said, national films. that we do have good source elements. If we only have a print of a film for the time being, this is not up for digitization in this project. Eventually, towards the end of the 40 years, if no better element has turned up, they will, of course, also be included. We have a directive from the government when they gave us the money that we had to focus on films for children and youth. We also want to make sure of to have a variation of periods, different types of films, not just do the big feature films, but experimental films, short films, animations, etc. And to have a variety of rights holders, because we are actually helping the rights holders by doing this work for them, you could say. And this is, if I dare use the word, a challenge in Sweden, because there is one major rights holder, that Svensk Filmindustri, which holds the rights to a large chunk of Swedish film heritage. But we really try to make sure when we choose the films that others will also benefit from the project. Films with uncertain legal status at the moment, we put them on hold. I will come back to it later why. When doing the selection, we're also kind of not... We want to make sure we're not just repeating the way history is being perceived. First of all, we don't digitize what has already been digitized by others. And by digitized by others, I mean in a quality good enough for theatrical screening. If a film is available on DVD only, then it can be included in our project because we think it's more or less irrelevant in this purpose. But Svensk Filmindustri, they have done maybe 60 of their most famous and commercially viable titles for them. And of course, we don't do them now. We are not extremely happy with the way they did it. Towards the end of the project, we hope we'll get around to those films as well. But for the time being, we skip them. We have an internal Film Institute agenda to highlight female creators. So this is also taken into consideration when we do the selection. We have agreements with the rights holders, of course, which determines their right to the material we create. And they can have access to our digital masters and DCPs to a fee. If they want the material in any other kind of format, broadcast format or whatever, they have to do it themselves. We won't do it for them. And the agreements also include what we have the right to do with the digital elements we have produced, which includes, of course, free screenings without prior notification in our own premises, but also that we can lend DCPs to external theaters for screening, which is one of the main purposes of the project, because with 35 millimeter prints, maybe there are five venues in Sweden who can screen archival films. With DCPs, there is more than 600 venues who can screen archival films. So we decided to reserve a quota of the 100 films every year to do digitizations on demand from rights holders. And I will also come back to why we did that. In order for us to include one of the films they want us to digitize, they have to produce a kind of release or distribution plan for the film, otherwise we won't do it. It's not just enough that the filmmaker says, oh, I would like to have my film available in DCP. Also, if we don't have elements of that film in our collection to digitize, to use as source elements, a requirement is that in order for us to digitize that film, they have to deposit the elements to the archive. Other plans for access for these films? Well, the films included in the quota for the rights holders in a way then have a guaranteed release plan already. We so far treated the DCPs we created as handling them the same way as we do with archival loans of prints. It turns out that for a lot of cinemas throughout Sweden. It was very complicated. They didn't quite understand. We have to ask you for the material and pay a handling fee for that, and then we have to ask someone else for the rights. So we are now negotiating with all the rights holders to actually have our own theatrical distribution of these films, which would only be national then. And also, the online site we have now is for free, and we like to keep it for free. We tried to include in the agreement, in the distribution agreements we're now making, that we could put them on our website also, but then it turned out to be impossible for the moment, because they would not allow that to be without geographical limitations and without users having to pay something. So we're now trying to find a way to, we have the elements and try to find a way to link the rights holders with other commercial providers of that kind of service. And the reason we focus a lot on access now for the first films we do is that we believe that if we can show that the films we have digitized are being readily used and often, we believe that our chances of getting additional funding after 2018 will increase. And hopefully by 2018 it will also be a funding on a more permanent level. But it's also important, I think, when you talk about digitization and making films available, what is it in fact we are making available? How should the final result be? As you could see, we hired 9 new staff, some of them very skillful, working 20, 30 years in the industry, having really no idea how, what an heritage film should look like, in a way, to be very honest. So we created a policy, a curatorial policy on the treatment of the sound and the image. And it was a way also to integrating the old staff with the new staff, the old archival staff with the new digital staff, to make them come together and to agree on a kind of common set of principles, which is very important, but it also helps us to resolve reoccurring issues. In the beginning, where there were always arguments about the same things on every film, so this was also one of the reasons. So what does this curatorial policy contain? What kind of source element is deemed fit to use, both for the sound and the image? The treatment of the image, the aspect ratio, of course, to respect original aspect ratio, but that in some cases the shooting ratio it was different from the projection ratio, like films in the 60s where the strip is in Academy, but it was supposed to be screened in widescreen, and that research has to be done on an individual title basis to make sure that the final DCP has the right projection ratio. Okay. And what happens when the source elements in themselves actually have the wrong aspect ratio, like downsized silent films which were duplicated erroneously in the 60s and 70s, etc., etc. The treatment of sound, of course, is a bit complicated. The image file is, of course, frame by frame. The sound file is a continuous file for every reel. Don't always match up. What can you do in terms of stretching and filling in gaps, etc.? I think I skipped one here. Oh, sorry, there were a few more things there I should go through. The stabilization, that in an original negative you have a splice, which means that the print would have made a little jump. Should it be kept? Should it not be kept? What if the splice, if the source element is not a negative but an interpositive? Is there a difference if there is a physical splice in the interpositive? Yes, I think there is, rather than if there is a duplicated splice, you have to choose the different options depending on things like that. Restoration, what does it mean? How much kind of things should be removed, and what kind of original defects should be kept? What about if the source element has changeover queues or censorship stamps? Should they be kept? Should they not be kept? What about if there is a missing frame? Then we come to the sound aspects. And then the approval stage. And now I forgot to talk about the most important thing, of course, which was the grading, which is really the crucial element when you try to recreate an analog film. We always screen a reference print in the cinema for the people going to work on that particular film. What is a reference print? This is very complicated too. Do we have an original print from the time of the film's release? Then we use that, but sometimes in terms of color films, the colors are faded. What do we do then? What about films from the nitrate era where there is no nitrate prints around? Can we trust duplications made in the 60s of these films? All these kind of questions. Then the final elements are approved. The digital master is approved by the monitor, by at least two people. The DCP is screened also from beginning to end in a cinema and is also approved. I put something here called arbitration. Sometimes people doing the approval don't agree, which in the final end would go back to the curator to decide if this is the good result or not. And very important aspect of this kind of policy is also to document everything you do to make sure that future generations can see what has been done and where and to what extent. The digital elements to preserve, of course, we preserve the raw scans for the sake of reversibility, of course, also untreated sound transfers. We preserve a digital master, a sound master, a DCP, and also a low-resolution access file. So for each film, 6 new digital elements are created. And I think it has worked very well. The purpose of integrating all the new team has been rather successful, still some problems. We, as I said, we avoid having discussions over reoccurring issues. You can go to the policy and say, okay, in this case we should do this, in this case we should definitely not do this. And it has facilitated the integration of also new staff. We hired 9 new people in one go. It turned out that a couple of them were maybe not so suitable, so we had to hire another 2. They came into the project later, but they had a policy which we could put in their hands immediately. And it's also for the sake of transparency, both when it comes to the selection part, but also when it comes to the curatorial part. We are now thinking of, when it comes to the selection part, to also establish, it's all being done by staff of the Institute. We are now also establishing an external reference group for the selection part. And if you want to have a look at them, they are available on our website also in English. And I think that was it. Thank you.